Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to Filibuster here on the Nerd Party Network. We're back after a week off to conclude our Christopher Nolan rewatch series with Interstellar and Dunkirk. So Dallas, we've made it to the end of this Christopher Nolan journey. We have been kind of coming in sort of like nice increments of sort of about a month each, whereas Tenet now is sort of getting pushed back in sort of 2 week increments. So it seems like we're still going to get kind of Tenet no longer in sort of July, but now in August 14th. What did you make of the news when it broke that it was going to be delayed further?
I mean, I think when we did our last episode, I think it was still, we were still going, oh, he hasn't moved it yet. And yeah, I mean, I think when they released the second trailer, when it said only in theatres, which is what, you know, Americans call their cinemas for some bizarre reason, you know, I think we kind of knew that they're hedging the bets, they're going to see what's going to happen, and it's probably going to move because, you know, the situation is still not going under control. So, and then they went, okay, we're going to delay it by 2 weeks, and everyone's like, oh, right, okay. And they went, okay, fine, you know, that's fine. You know, they're going to give us a 10th anniversary, you know, Inception screening with some teaser footage of Tenet, Wonder Woman 84 in June. Absolutely, yes, I will go to the cinema to watch that, even if I just watch the teaser footage and then leave before the main film because no one's wearing a mask. And then, you know, basically, thankfully, you know, they did it before we recorded this podcast. You know, they might still delay it again by the time this goes out. But, you know, they basically waited until the cinemas started doing their programming for reopening and then said, actually, you know, things aren't looking good in New York and Los Angeles, the two biggest markets in America, so we're actually going to bump it another 2 weeks. And I can see a situation where in a couple of weeks they're going to bump it another 2 weeks, and then I think was it Kamal Nanjini sort of tweeted that basically, you know, they keep bumping it by 2 weeks, and then it's like Tenet is released in 2028, and it's like we're living in increments of 2 weeks until this film finally comes out. So I can completely understand the reasons by it. You know, it's all about keeping people safe. You know, I think the news that cinemas were not really wanting to mandate people wearing masks in even at least the foyers of the cinema until they got into the screen, start munching the popcorn, was a bit of a red flag for many people. But I will still be there, you know, on opening day of Tenet. You know, I did book off the 31st and then had to immediately cancel it because they did then move the date. So I've now booked off I think it's the 12th of August or the 14th of August, something like that. I've booked that off. I'll change that date again if I have to, but I will go in with some gloves. I will wear a mask. I will have my prepackaged sweets, which I bought in a supermarket before going in. I'll bring antibacterial hand gel. I will enjoy the film, and then I will leave straight away because, you know, at least Christopher Nolan doesn't bother with, you know, end credit stings or anything like that. I'll just pick up the soundtrack at home and listen to the end credit music there, I think. But yeah, no, I'm looking forward to it. But I think they're making the right call at the moment. But I think it's a weird time for cinemas. And I know there's a lot of cinemas now that basically have a month of playing old classic films on the big screen. So it's maybe a bit of a worry for them because I know Mulan and everything else has moved. But you know, I'm still getting annoyed at the discourse still going on that Christopher Nolan is essentially killing people by putting his film out in cinemas when that's never actually been the case. He's always said it's there for when they're ready, but, you know.
I think there's been, the discourse is, God, it's absolutely chronic. I mean, everything about this film is being criticised. I mean, we discussed it on sort of our other podcast where, like, you have St. Maud, an A24 film, that probably realistically could be dropped onto VOD in America. You have Proxima, a sort of, you know, film that's getting dropped into kind of cinemas here in the UK. That's another one that probably realistically could be dropped onto VOD, but it is getting dropped there. And Tenet seems to be the lightning rod for all the criticism about it all. I mean, no one's complaining where I've seen it, the local audience have started putting up their showtimes. So things like Inception are up, Dunkirk, Dark Knight Trilogy, Booksmart, you know, Bohemian Rhapsody. You know, yeah, I think there's an argument to be made of, like, Does people really need to see La La Land so desperately that, you know, that they're willing to risk their lives? Yeah, well, I probably will go see it. But it's things like that where you have this discourse and then people are kind of saying, well, why are they just pushing it back 2 weeks, 2 weeks, 2 weeks? When, like, you know, why not just say we'll push it back to 2021? Well, I mean, the ultimate thing is, like, whatever films kind of get dropped between now and sort of October, November have kind of a free run. So it's not orthodox by any stretch of the imagination, but Tenet could easily just go, okay, we're going to just push it back every sort of 2 weeks, because they certainly have a long road towards doing it. There's really no pressure on them. There's not in term, they, it's not going to, you know, step on any toes, like, say, No Time to Die until sort of November time. So, like, it can take this soft approach as opposed to, like, being kind of firm on sort of this end of July time. So I will see it the same as you, you know, probably bring a knife in case anyone comes kind of close to me. But, yeah, I'll be 100% seeing it sort of opening day. I mean, I had that the end of July off. I needed to take some annual leave with my work. But no, I'll take a flexi day or something in mid-August and go see it and enjoy it. So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it. I'm glad it's still something to look forward to on the horizon.
I mean, the scheduling thing is, if anything, it's just going to bump other Warner Brother films down the line. It will take the Wonder Woman spot at the end of August, and then that will in turn probably take the June spot at November, and then June will probably sort of bump to probably February, something like that, you know. So it's only going to affect the Warner Brothers releases. But I mean, one thing that they're not really talking about, they're talking about the be all and end all as being, you know, the US and the UK. It's us who sort of say, oh, I want to see Tenet now. But there's a lot of countries around the world, such as New Zealand and, you know, sort of Japan, places that have gotten on top of it and are reopening, and they're needing new films to screen. And the fact, you know, they'll have been waiting for Tenet and stuff as well. So, you know, it's not all about, I mean, obviously, for recouping a lot of the budget, yes, the US is the biggest theatrical market for them. So obviously, you know, it's the biggest one that counts. But there are other countries around the world who've managed to get on top of it and do want to see new films. So, you know, it's a difficult one, because obviously, you know, something like Tenet, I can imagine being spoiled mercilessly by audiences who just have no self-control on social media. But, you know, there's maybe other films like Ascent Mod and stuff that could get a gradual, we could be looking at the return of sort of staggered releases. You know, no longer does everything have to be released in every single country around the world on the same day, you know. So it's an interesting, going to be an interesting few months ahead. Yeah, but I guess you're probably glad that the Scottish cinemas are reopening now, so you don't have to cross the border and drive down to, like, Newcastle or Carlisle to see a screening of it.
No, exactly. I was debating at one point where it felt like, oh my god, England are going to get Tenet before us. They're not going to wait for Scotland. And I wonder if I would have to go to Carlisle View or something like that. Thankfully, that is no longer the case. And I have a feeling, even though I've just, the two films we're about to watch today, even though I've rewatched them over the weekend, I probably could imagine a scenario where I'm going into the cinema with my mask to watch these kind of films again, because I'm just desperate for something different to do.
I'm still kind of swithering about what would actually get me back in the cinema. I know there's going to be apparently a 4K release of Empire Strikes Back. Now, that's a film I haven't seen the big screen for about 23 years. Yeah, 23 years. So yeah, I would definitely go see that. Everything else, I think it would depend on if I saw that one first, see how the cinema manages, you know, the situation with people staying social distance and the cleanliness and all that sort of stuff. That would be a benchmark for me. And then if it looked like it was reasonable, then I probably would go back and see other things. I mean, they're going to be taking my money from my unlimited card anyway, so I might go back. But I think one of the things, the biggest things at the moment on social media, is this whole sort of people sort of slagging people off for wanting to go back to the cinema. You know, the cinema is like one of my very few hobbies I really do enjoy, and the fact that I haven't been able to do it for 3 months and stuff, I just want to get back to some sort of sense of normality. Now, I totally get that some people are not going to be comfortable going back until either there's a vaccine or, you know, there's something, you know, that makes them feel safer, and that's completely all right. But, you know, each to their own, and I think people should be allowed to, you know, if I have to self-isolate for 14 days after Tenet, I will. It's, you know, I will. I can work from home, it'll be fine.
Yeah, so we'll dive into our two kind of last films that will take us nicely up to Tenet. And the first one is Interstellar. So Earth's future has been riddled by disasters, famine and droughts. There's only one way to ensure mankind's survival, interstellar travel. A newly discovered wormhole in the far reaches of our solar system allows a team of astronauts to go where no man has gone before, a planet that may have the right environment to sustain human life. So Dallas, what was your first experience with Interstellar in 2014?
I think it was watching it in the Belmont cinema. Actually, I think I tried to get a 35mm print, but since I was the only person there... Actually, no, we did get a 35mm print of it. There was a few of us actually still by that point. I've completely forgotten. Yeah, no, we did manage to get a 35mm print for a couple of screenings of it. And yeah, so that would have been it. So obviously having to test the film in advance was a great thing. But yeah, this for me is probably Christopher Nolan's probably most misunderstood film, I think is probably the best way I could say it. I know a lot of people are not fans of The Dark Knight Rises. I mean, it's obviously it's a difficult one coming off the back of The Dark Knight. I mean, I know I said in the last episode that I'd prefer The Dark Knight Rises, but I can see why some people maybe don't like it. I think you were sort of not as keen on as I was, but I think for some reason or another, this one really sort of missed the mark for a lot of audiences. And sort of rewatching it sort of for this, I really sort of failed to understand why, because, you know, I can get it because, you know, 2001, I wasn't a fan of that film when I first saw it. And then I've sort of rewatched it several times in the cinema and I can really appreciate the sort of grandiose nature of it. And this is a film which really, you know, for pardon the pun, shoots for the stars and maybe on occasion doesn't quite, you know, live up to what it's aiming at. But you've got to admire the ambition of what he's trying to do with this, I think.
Yeah, I would agree. Like, I saw this opening weekend in 2014, and this was one I was really excited for, sort of. I'm a huge sci-fi fan, and I find the challenges of getting good original sci-fi films is becoming harder and harder to get. It's mostly reboots, reimaginings, sequels. There's nothing where it's like a good quality hard sci-fi kind of movie. So I was really excited for Interstellar going in, and my first screening I went to see was an IMAX print, and I was just absolutely blown away by sort of, it felt very fresh for kind of Christopher Nolan, where I think it was like the fact that we're escaping kind of planet Earth. And while there's still the odd kind of, you know, Nolan sort of regular in terms of, say, someone like Willem Devane pops up for a second film in a row, and we have Michael Caine, we've got a whole load of new kind of actors coming in. It's kind of something that feels very sort of original in terms of the kind of plot. And I just thought it was really good to sort of see Christopher Nolan do something this epic out in kind of space. I think for me, this is my favorite kind of Christopher Nolan film, and one that I've really enjoyed sort of watching in kind of cinemas. And I was lucky enough a couple of years ago to get a ticket to see it performed at the Albert Hall. So Christopher Nolan was in attendance, sort of giving a talk before the film with sort of Dr. Brian Cox, Kip Thorne, and the late, great Stephen Hawking, who I nearly tripped over on my way into my seat. So it was crazy. They had this red carpet just near where sort of my entrance door was to the Albert Hall. And I was like, oh my God, it's like Stephen Hawking. I can't believe it. So I was like, all right, I'll head off into my area now. And then I kind of was heading it up the kind of steps, the ramp into the seating area. And I was like, what's that noise behind me? And it was Stephen Hawking coming up behind me. And I was so startled, I nearly collapsed onto him. So yeah, like Interstellar will have a lot of memories for me. But I just think it's one of those films where everything kind of Christopher Nolan does so well kind of comes together. And I think it bothers me when we talk about kind of discourse around Christopher Nolan. And I think we can touch on it in Dunkirk as well, where people talk about him as sort of like, he's not this smart filmmaker, he just makes everyone think that they're smart for liking a Christopher Nolan film. But the idea, like, you have this movie about sort of interstellar travel, wormholes, time being different on other planets. These are things, like, as a sci-fi fan, I feel like I have had a good concept of since I was a little kid, because I had a great education on something like Star Trek. But, like, you put this in a cinema audience, could you imagine a Star Wars movie or a Star Trek film or whatever getting away without the, you know, the sound vacuum in space, or having them, you know, Rey or Finn, Luke Skywalker, go down to planet, and then they come back to the Millennium Falcon, and like 10 hours has passed on the ship and it's been 10 years on the planet. You know, all these sorts of things. I just find really fascinating that Nolan is able to use those things, and sort of, he doesn't sort of make it sort of like pop sci-fi or something like that. He really goes for a hard sci-fi film, but at the heart of it, it's such a loving story about this father and a daughter. And I think, you know, I've said it with some of the other Nolan films, somewhat like Inception as well, where it's quite a cold film in terms of the dialogue and the approach. Whereas this, I think it's got such a lovely story at the heart of it about a father and a daughter becoming estranged through time and space.
You know, one thing that I really sort of appreciate about this film, and it's maybe one of the things which sort of alienates casual moviegoers, is the fact that it tried to be as close to the science as possible, like you say, working with like Kip Thorne and stuff, to basically say, well, how would this ship sort of be able to navigate around the black hole if it did go on this planet which was near a black hole? Time would speed up, so therefore by the time they get back, it's been 28 years and stuff like that. And it's all that kind of stuff I really found fascinating, you know, this kind of stuff. You know, I'd watch sort of documentaries and stuff on this kind of thing all the time. I watched a recent documentary about Einstein and his theory of relativity and all that, and it was just like, this kind of stuff really sort of, it takes a lot of boxes for me. You know, when you think, you know, this, the Star Wars sort of franchise had not come back, that would have been 2015, so that would have been the year after. So I mean, in terms of sort of big budget sci-fi, you're probably looking at the sort of Star Trek reboots, even though they're technically in the same universe. Or you'd be going back to, you know, this is a world away from the likes of your Armageddons and, you know, the Saving the Earth films, or, you know, the bad science of a film like The Core, which has found a sort of cult following in years and stuff like that. But I really saw it was, it's much more in keeping with it. Like you say, it's quite cold at times, which is, it's similar, very similar to sort of 2001, which is like, this is how space is. And I'm sorry if that doesn't appeal to your Star Wars sort of ideals, but you know, this is what it is, and I'm going to stick to it. And I think it's really admirable that he commits to it. And like you say, it's got this, it's about science, but then it's like you say, this human story of one man. You know, he brings in Matthew McConaughey, who's sort of just basically approaching the cusp of the reconnaissance, and you know, he brings in sort of like Jessica Chastain as the older version of his daughter. You know, one thing I'd completely forgotten about before the rewatch is the fact that he discovered Timothée Chalamet before, you know, all the teenage girls had. You know, he played the young version of the son who sort of grows into sort of Casey Affleck. You've got, you know, like the return of like Topher Grace from A Couple of Years in the Wilderness following Spider-Man 3. Like, so you've got, you know, John Lithgow, Michael Caine, David Oyelowo is in a small role as well and stuff like that. Anne Hathaway, of course, you know, he'd one of his regular collaborators now following from The Dark Knight Rises. And then, you know, one major character who is talked about, and a name was mentioned when it was first sort of announced that this film was happening, and then everyone seemed surprised when he turned up, but I was kind of not, because I kind of remembered the press release where he talked about him. And, you know, we can get onto that in a bit, but, you know,
I thought you were going to talk about TARS there for a second, the way you were talking of, like, this hidden character. And I was like, I almost completely forgot that we were going to go down talking about Matt Damon there. I was thinking, like, oh, yeah, he's talking about TARS.
Yeah, no, it's one
of the underrated characters of the film.
Yeah, no, I mean, he is, yeah. But, yeah, no, it's like the fact that Matt Damon turns up as one of the, you know, the astronauts who'd gone off to investigate these planets in the first place. And it just sort of adds to the sort of joke about the amount of money that the US government is spent on trying to retrieve Matt Damon from situations like The Martian and Saving Private Ryan and stuff like that. But I mean, it does have a lot of, it's about this sort of father-daughter connection, which, you know, all sort of comes together in the end, and it's most blatantly sort of 2001 sort of sequence within the Tesseract, not the MCU Tesseract, but an actual Tesseract. But, you know, it's a kind of, it's a film which sadly has almost become sort of meme worthy of, I mean, I'm just thinking of like the Matthew McConaughey watching the Star Wars trailer sort of thing, and then it being ad infinitum. You know, it's basically going to be, you know, audiences, when they finally get to see Tenet on the big screen, it's just going to be that video of Matthew McConaughey crying, laughing, crying, tears of joy and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's sort of been a bit of a maligned Christopher Nolan film, but it's got so much ambition, which, and when you see it, I mean, like the soundtrack by Hans Zimmer, it is one of his best. And I mean, I feel very jealous of you seeing it at the Royal Albert Hall. I know I saw Hans Zimmer live at the Hammersmith Apollo in late 2014, but it was October. But you know, he didn't want to spoil the music. He didn't want to do a Qui-Gon's Noble End or Qui-Gon's Funeral by playing any music from the film before it came out. But luckily, he did play some of the Interstellar score when I saw him at the SSE Hydro in Glasgow, not in Edinburgh, if you watch the new revision movie on Netflix. And that was just fantastic. I mean, that sort of church organ stuff and things, like the I think one of the standout tracks is probably the docking sequence where Matt Damon's trying to dock with the ship. I mean, that sort of score is just sensational, I think. Well, I mean, what did you make of, I mean, Hans Zimmer is basically synonymous now with Nolan. I know he's not doing Tenet, he's doing Dune instead and stuff like that, but I mean, what did you make of this particular musical score?
I loved it, Dallas. I absolutely loved it. And what I think is so good, and I think Nolan does so incredibly well, is climaxes. Like, I just think the tension in this movie, with sort of the ticking of the clock as well, like, obviously time is so important in this film. I mean, it's crazy to think, like, they're in a race to save kind of humanity, and it all kind of takes place in sort of this condensed period of time for these characters, but the reality is it kind of goes over decades, and I think the score complements the film so well. It was definitely, like, the use of the organ I loved as well. I never sort of considered it sort of an important piece of sort of like soundtracks till this film. I thought it was great, and I just think that score, when it kind of rises towards the end, as sort of Cooper's about to kind of go out there, catch up with Anne Hathaway's character, I just think it all comes together so well. And one of my favourite memories of that event was, whenever I watch the film now, I think of the scene where, like, you've got Matt Damon's character, he's taking, like, his little shuttle pod back up to the ship, he's wanting to connect, and it's like this 15 minute bit of, like, Zimmer's just building the tension, the score's getting louder, it's getting tenser, it's getting louder, it's getting tenser, it's getting louder, and then obviously there's the explosion and it's silence, and, like, everyone in this audience, I think it's like 15,000 people you get at the Albert Hall and a sold out event, just burst into spontaneous applause. And it's little moments like that where you watch in the cinema, you go, wow, what a moment. But when you watch it with, like, the orchestra and a crowd, and it's just something spontaneous like that, it's not just like a ripple of applause where one person starts everyone. It's just, it's such recognition for the score. And I know Zimmer and Nolan were like, they were told, you can do whatever film you want. I mean, if they'd said The Following, they probably would have got a sold out audience. But the fact that they chose Interstellar to perform live, I think, was really telling and sort of about sort of how they view the score. And I think it's such a huge kind of character in the film.
Yeah, I mean, that moment where, like you say, the music almost gets sort of sucked out into the vacuum of space. It's up there with The Last Jedi. I'm going to stand The Last Jedi again, the moment where Laura Dern takes her ship and goes straight through a Star Destroyer, and it basically sucks all the sound out of the screen as well. It's just an incredible moment. And yeah, no, it's interesting to see sort of Matt Damon in there as essentially the villain of the piece. Certainly a very conflicted character, someone who's been on his own, has basically gone into hypersleep thinking he's not going to wake up, and then sort of sees his shot. You know, it's that thing of, you know, it's an old sci-fi trope of he's set an SOS sort of beacon sort of thing, and basically, of course, they go, basically they go to his planet on the basis of this beacon, and of course, you know, everything goes wrong, you know, that's because, you know, that's what happens in a sci-fi movie, you've got to have that. But, I mean, ultimately, like you say, it comes down to this father-daughter thing, and I love the way it all sort of dovetails back in together in the fact, you know, it's, the film's been out for sort of 6 years, so we can kind of talk about spoilers, and the fact that, you know, this message that they find in the sort of bookcase and stuff like that sends Coop on his way and sort of becomes estranged from his daughter, and then you find out that he's actually the one that sent the message and at the same time gives his daughter the details of how to save humanity as well, you know, when she's grown up, when she's sort of like 40 years old. And it really is, it's incredibly sort of powerful stuff and a real sort of gut punch at the end. And I don't know how anyone can sort of fail to feel anything during that sort of final stretch. And the fact that he sort of keeps up that momentum, sort of, I mean, this film is, I think it's about 163 minutes or something like that. At this, you know, his longest film to date. And yet there doesn't feel like any wasted moment in that. And I know that they talk about, it's the great thing about the Nolan, he's always playing with time, but, you know, time sort of condenses and stretches in various parts of the film. But, you know, this is nearly a 3-hour film, which never feels like a 3-hour film. And I think that's what's so great about Nolan. He knows pacing and stuff, and a lot of that comes down to the Zimmer score, and it's certainly one that he repeats in the next film as well, and how he uses it to enhance the tension and the mood and stuff like that.
Yeah, so kind of moving on to our next film and sort of the prequel really to sort of Tenet, and that's Dunkirk. So the story of a miraculous evacuation of Allied soldiers from Belgium, Britain, Canada and France who were cut off and surrounded by the German army from the beaches and harbour of Dunkirk between May 26 and June 4th, 1940 during World War II. Stalas, what was your opening weekend experience like with Dunkirk?
My opening weekend experience, I think I saw it on just my regular Cineworld on the big screen. And then opening weekend, I think I got the train down to Glasgow to see it on IMAX, and then got the train through to Edinburgh to see it on 70mm at Film House. And the IMAX screening was not great because the IMAX projector, basically they have two projectors, in order to get a crystal clear image, and the two projectors were not aligned, so therefore the image was slightly out of focus. And I did that thing of immediately went out, told someone, and basically they said that there wasn't really anything they could do because they would have to shut down the film, reboot the projectors, and basically didn't have enough time to do that in between screenings. And for some bizarre reason, I was the only one who seemed to come out and complain about this, but I was with someone else, and he was happy to stay, so essentially we ended up staying to watch it. If you looked at the right in the middle of the screen, it was in focus, but the rest of it wasn't, so yeah, I kind of had to do that. But then thankfully when I went to see it on 70mm, the projection was top notch, as I would expect nothing less from the team at Film House, David Boyd, Ali and all the projectionists there, and got to go up and see one of the screenings in progress, and then I got to watch it on the big screen, and it was just fantastic. And it was a film which is so much better than 1917. I'll still not get over the fact that everyone seemed to really give Oscar 1917 an Oscar push, and Dunkirk, even though it did get nominated for a couple of things, it didn't seem to get the same sort of buzz, and I don't know why, because I think it's a much more engaging film. I mean, I think we both were sort of not a fan of the sort of first-person video game style of it, and the fact that it sort of takes places over sort of three different timelines, but then Nolan does that thing of being able to bring it all together in the end, is just a really sort of interesting take on it. And you know, it's weird, it's everyone talks at the moment about the Blitz spirit, the Dunkirk spirit, you know, we can do anything, you know. I'm surprised this Dunkirk hasn't been adopted by everyone during this sort of COVID coronavirus calamity, that, you know, oh well, you know, we managed to get everyone back from Dunkirk, all right, you know, we should all watch Dunkirk and stuff like that. You know, I'm glad it hasn't been adopted by these idiots who think it's actually going well. What about yourself?
Yeah, I had a very similar weekend to you. This was one where I felt like it was like one of these Pokemons. You've got to catch them all. So my opening viewing was 70mm at the Film House. Then I went to see an IMAX, and then I went to sort of see it in standard digital. And I thankfully had a good IMAX experience with it, and the 70mm was also fantastic as well. I thought this was an excellent film. And again, it's one of these ones like it annoys me, again, sort of the discourse with Nolan of, like, we've talked about with Interstellar, where it's like how they use time, and I think it's quite clever that he's managed to get into a mainstream audience. Like, I always kind of viewed it as a a thing where I was like going into Dunkirk, I was like, right, you've got this Lancean heir. Everyone kind of knew that was a thing going in. But I don't think anyone knew this sort of like 1 week for on the beaches, 1 day for the boat, and 1 hour for the planes. I remembered watching that like first like screening. I was like, right, okay, this is a bit of a surprise. Just getting my head a little round sort of the concept. But I thought it was such a great way to sort of tell this story. And I almost think what I praise Interstellar for, sort of not having that kind of cold emotional core, what I really like about Dunkirk is that it avoids a lot of the cliched tropes that that we see in sort of some of these war movies, where I think there's only one moment really where things like soar to an emotional beat, where it's like it cuts to Kenneth Branagh's character and he's like, what do you see? I see home, as like the ships come in and like the Zimmer score kind of things. Like, it's just, it's a horrible thing to be involved in, like on this beach. It's, and I think that this kind of dispassionate, detached, broken characters that we kind of see, I think it makes for such an interesting kind of film, and the concept of how they tie them all together. And I think, you know, people that do Nolan a disservice when they are, probably his fans as well, when they say that films like this sort of just make people feel smart. I don't see many sort of independent movies, some of the, you know, most acclaimed films, doing the things that Christopher Nolan does to sort of tell this story that he does in Dunkirk. And it would be so much, it would be so easy, and especially for Warner Brothers, to go, now we want a conventional story within a conventional period where we're not asking the audience too much to kind of go along with.
Yeah, no, it's normal, because I think I remember actually that whole sort of the time thing where, like you say, it takes over 1 week, 1 day, 1 hour. I mean, I'm pretty sure I was able to sort of, I can't remember when I cottoned on exactly, but sort of going into the second and third sort of screenings, you can actually sort of almost find the point when people start to figure out that it's all towards the end of the film, that all these things are sort of happening at the same time. Because like, there's a bit in the boat with Mark Rylance and stuff where the planes are going over, and then you like thinking, all right, is that that's the same planes? And then they're sort of picking up sort of like Jack Loudon and stuff like that. And then you see Cillian Murphy on one boat, and then, but he's already on the boat, been picked up and stuff. So you're sort of kind of piecing it together. But it was never a sort of a distraction for me, or, you know, something that took me out of the film. It was just, that was a really sort of interesting way of telling the story, and how, you know, all these different things were having to happen in order to, for the success of the mission. I mean, I remember, like, I think it was some woman next to me in the IMAX screening who was sort of like really, she was basically like had her fingers, like she was on the edge of her seat, fingers on the handrail, sort of like just digging in the whole time. She was so incredibly nervous and tense about everything that was happening. And then I think it's like the bit towards the end where I think it's like Kenneth Branagh sort of looking up, and one of the loose fallen sort of planes is coming in looking like it's going to bomb everyone, and he's sort of like putting his, you know, he's got his hat down, his eyes are closed, he's thinking this is it. And then sort of Tom Hardy's plane comes in and saves the day, and she was just like, yeah, she was almost like jumping out of her seat in excitement about, you know, Tom Hardy saving the day, because of course she would. And I mean, sort of Tom Hardy's performance for me in this, out of all of them, is probably the standout one, and the fact that once again he's handicapped by Christopher Nolan by having a mask on for his face, but you can, his performance is so emotive from the eyes. And there's that scene where he's sort of trying to work out, he's basically out of fuel, and he's thinking, right, I can either turn around and make it back home safely, or I can stay here, save this ship, save some guys, and either sort of, you know, jettison into the ocean, or sort of land on the beach and take my chances. And you can see him weighing it up in his head. You can see him, every thought's going through, and it's that sort of performance is just fantastic for me. You know, it's a film full of great performances. Sort of like Jack Loudon is someone that we weren't really familiar with at the time. You know, I think it was like the summer after was when Caliber came out, the EIFF, and realised just how good he was. But, you know, Nolan, as always, is, you know, he's got his finger on the pulse. He can spot talent. And of course, you know, the biggest, you know, casting thing of this film clearly was the Harry Styles effect. And I'd be keen to, curious, what did you make of One Direction's own star? What did you think of his performance in this one?
Well, I'm going to drop a little surprise before we talk about Harry Styles. Before you ever joined Filibuster, Jack Loudon was actually on this podcast. I interviewed him the summer before Dunkirk came out at sort of the Edinburgh Film Festival, and we had like the briefest little chat in our interview about this upcoming film, Dunkirk. So here's a little bit from Jack Loudon where he talks about working with Christopher Nolan.
And obviously you've got Dunkirk coming up this month as well. It must be kind of feel like a bit of a roller coaster just now, that gone from the days of bunch of Scots going around in a van. Like, what was it like working with Christopher Nolan on like this epic movie, you know?
It was amazing. You know, I first and foremost, you know, I think like a lot of people, I'm a fan of his films. Yeah. Massive fan. You know, every time a film came out, you would run to see it. So that alone was amazing to experience, to watch the guy work. And he really is, he's there with his shirt sleeves rolled up, that guy. He's a true filmmaker. He's brilliant.
Absolutely.
He really is, and the whole experience was insane. I went from this to Dunkirk in the space of 2 weeks, I think it was. So it was from one end to the other.
Is it difficult to get yourself into that kind of mindset from going from, you know, this small movie that you made in 30 days with what feels probably like your pals to the sprawling out, you're going, oh, there's Kenneth Branagh, there's about 6,000, you know.
It is strange, it is bizarre, but, you know, they weren't particularly starry actors in either project. They're brilliant big actors in both, but nobody was particularly starry. You know, I think it's British filmmaking, you know, British actors.
So there we go. No one expected Jack Loudon to appear on this podcast when they started tuning in, but here he is.
I'm shocked and stunned. This is like a third act plot twist here.
Yeah, he actually doesn't live too far away from me. He lives here in Leith. I've seen him several times.
Yes, you've been stalking him in Saoirse Ronan on the beach.
Everyone seems to be seeing him kind of kicking around. So, yeah, it was good to kind of get an idea, talk to someone about working with kind of Christopher Nolan. So, but yeah, in terms of Harry Styles, like with any other sort of director, I'd be like, oh, okay, right, it's going to be Harry Styles. But with Christopher Nolan, it's like, yeah, Christopher Nolan, he has an eye for casting, count me in. I think Harry Styles is sort of like a Jack the Lad English git, was really well cast. I thought he was very good in this film. I refuse to believe the thing of like Nolan being like, oh, I didn't know he was like a musician.
Yeah, no, it's, I don't believe the other sort of rumour, which was basically was Warner Brothers forced to cast him in the film to appeal to a younger audience. Yeah, I don't buy that one either.
Yeah, I thought he was really good. It'll be interesting to see if he appears in sort of future kind of Nolan films. But yeah, I think this was so well kind of put together. And I thought the sound design was one of my kind of favourite parts of this, especially kind of watching it in IMAX. And what I think about the film, and you touched on it there, sort of it's not been picked up by certain groups of people as a film to perhaps kind of rally around a Blitz spirit. I don't know about you, but a few months ago I was listening to the Rewatchables podcast, and they got Quentin Tarantino on, and he spoke about this film as being one of his favourite films of the past decade, and sort of his take on it as sort of a director was absolutely fascinating to kind of listen to. So if anyone has, you know, after they get to the end of this podcast, I would really recommend sort of listening to Quentin Tarantino with his full kind of pomp and you know, passion talking about why he loved this film and sort of talking about his experience of, I'd love to be party of this, where like he says that Nolan puts on screenings before his films are released, where he gets like all these directors that he loves and part of the Hollywood industry, they'll go to like the Chinese theater and watch his films and they'll have like a talk. I'm thinking like, I would love to be in that party.
Yeah, you got to be in the room where it happened.
Yeah, exactly. What do you think, like when you think about this film, we've kind of got to the end of our sort of Nolan film, where do you kind of place this kind of film? Because when I watched it at the weekend, I think that was the first full time I'd sort of watched it since the kind of, I watched it three times at the cinema. I kind of started it sometimes but never finished it, and that was no sort of insult or anything to the film. I just sort of had something kind of would come up or whatever. How do you kind of feel about this film in terms of like, it's been sort of 3-4 years now since the film was released? It doesn't seem to kind of have the audience or perhaps the discourse or debate that some of the other films have.
Yeah, it's one that actually turns out after, you know, sort of a crazy weekend of seeing it sort of maybe 3 or 4 times, you know, once it sort of went out of the cinema, I actually, for this rewatch, I got my my Blu-ray of it, and it turned out that my Blu-ray was still in the cellophane wrapper, so I actually had to unwrap it. So I actually hadn't seen it for a while. I know it's on Netflix at the moment, so if anyone is looking to complete their Nolan rewatch, they can catch it on Netflix at the moment. But it was still an incredibly sort of powerful and fantastic experience to watch. I think on an emotional level, it maybe isn't as maybe engaging as something like, say, Saving Private Ryan, where, unlike, you know, 1917, where you are in it, you know, you've got, you're in it at the beginning with the sort of landing on Omaha Beach and stuff like that. But I think it's the performances of like Tom Hanks and Matt Damon and stuff like that are, you spend, because you're spending the whole movie with that particular band of characters, you maybe have a bit of a stronger emotional connection with them. Because you are jumping between the three stories, there's maybe not as much time to get that connection. But I think it really does sort of show, you know, the horror of, you know, that it makes you incredibly tense. I mean, the tension of it is sustained throughout the whole thing, you know. What it would have been like, you do get a sense of what it would have been like for those guys of just standing there waiting, you know, to be rescued, wondering if it was going to be your turn to get out to safety, or whether or not you were going to get picked off on the beaches, whether it was by the bombers or the advancing sort of German troops. And I mean, certainly the British spirit of you know, the Beale, the keep the British end up of the all the boats coming across, yes, it maybe does stray into slight sort of elements of cheese towards the end with it, like you say, the sort of seeing home sort of thing in the mall, that sort of crest of the wave of the Zimmer score as it comes in there. But I think in terms of, like, I mean, this sort of, I think it's called the track of like the supermarine sequence, where the moment where all three stories start to come together at the same time and are driven by that incredible score, which uses, as I would expect, nothing less, Christopher Nolan's own pocket watch as a musical instrument is just fantastic. And yeah, I mean, it's probably sort of mid to upper tier for me, I think, of the sort of Christopher Nolan films. I think, you know, Memento still makes an incredible impression for me as his sort of first film, which I saw in. Following was his first, but Memento was the first one which I saw. Prestige for me is still, they encapsulate everything about Nolan as a director and a filmmaker for me. Inception is still, you know, we're looking at 10 years now getting a re-release, it's still one of the best sort of Hollywood blockbusters of the last decade, last 10 years. And for me, there's not a better superhero sort of trilogy / saga / series. You know, the MCU, what they've done is unparalleled, but there is differing levels of quality in the episodes. And I think for three films sort of back to back, I think no one is best. So I'd say Prestige, Dark Knight Trilogy, Memento, then sort of Interstellar, Dunkirk, I think, for me. I think it's where I would be at, perhaps.
I think what I love about Dunkirk, and you know, it's no slight on my rewatch of it, is that, like, it is a film that is made for the cinema experience, in terms of the, you know, I've got a good sound system here, I've got a good TV, but it doesn't pack the same punch as like a big IMAX screen. Or like, I remembered sort of when those like planes were kind of going over my head, it was deafening, and the score and everything, it feels like the perfect kind of cinema experience, and I absolutely love it for that. And it doesn't pack the same punch at home, but that's okay, because I think that's Christopher Nolan's sort of main intention, is like, you have to deliver on the cinematic experience. And if you have that moment in the cinema, like, you carry that with you for life. You know, there's very few times I go, you know what, I watched this film at home and it packed this amazing experience for me. I will enjoy a film, you know, it might touch me on an emotional level, but it will never be an experience. And that's why when I see some of the, you know, debate where it's like, oh, just put Tenet on to VOD and maybe we'll get a cinema release one day down the line. It's like, I will wait for the film, whether it's every 2 weeks I have to kind of get pushed back for, or if it ends up being next year. I want that first experience to be in the cinema. And, you know, Dunkirk, I think, is a good film. I gave it a 4 on my rewatch, whereas a sort of a 4.5 in sort of the cinema experience. But yeah, I think it's a great film, and it has me excited for the next film. It feels like it's been a long time coming for Tenet.
Yeah, no, I mean, I guess it is. It's only sort of 3 years, but it does seem like a long time since Dunkirk. So yeah, we're ready for it. And I mean, I guess in terms of the cinematic experience, you wouldn't be going to see Tenet in a drive-in cinema then, listening to the score and the dialogue on a car radio then.
I think that's a terrible idea, isn't it? I've seen some people saying like that film should be there. I really don't think sort of like, I mean, to be fair, I never really expected they did an Inception rewatch thing on Fortnite recently. So God knows what, like, you know, maybe it will actually happen and stuff. God knows what's going on there. But no, I'm not keen on this whole drive-in cinema experience. Like, I think the prices are ridiculous. I don't have a car. I think the sound quality would be rubbish. I wouldn't mind seeing like sort of an old school film or something like that, paying a couple bucks for a bit of a laugh, but it's not the way I would want to see one of these films for the first time.
Yeah, no, I don't have a car either, so I'm wondering if I could get into one in like one of those sort of little Tykes Cozy Coupe sort of child plastic cars, and like take a ham transistor radio or something and a pair of wireless headphones and stuff like that, and do it that way. But because, you know, cars are bad for the environment and stuff like that, and I don't want to have to renew my license and hire a car in order to go to the cinema. I just want to be in a dark room wearing a mask and like Bane, and just enjoying it then. And hopefully it's not too long before we all get to do that again.
So I think we've obviously recommended the Christopher Nolan films for people to, we say, check them out for the first time.
He's an alright filmmaker, isn't he? He's alright.
So what would you recommend people maybe haven't seen or check out, or anything that you would recommend people get behind? I would recommend personally that people would, we've mentioned them on this podcast, we've mentioned them on numerous other podcasts, I would recommend people would get behind sort of the Film House in Edinburgh and the Bellman Film House in Aberdeen, and get behind sort of their campaign, sort of a fundraiser they've got on at the moment, whereas we're talking about cinemas like, you know, the Cineworlds, the AMCs, you know, such like, all kind of opening big for Tenet and that. These smaller independent cinemas, it's going to be more difficult for them to sort of transition into this new normal. So they've got a huge kind of fundraiser going at the moment. So I think the Film House in Edinburgh is looking to raise 60,000, and the Bellman in Aberdeen is looking to raise about 25,000. So if you're like me and you can donate a couple of quids, you know, it all makes a huge difference, you know, whether it's the price of a membership, a ticket to a matinee, you know. Okay, most of us probably buy our food from Sainsbury's or what have you before going to see a film. If you want to donate the cost of a popcorn or something like that, it all goes towards securing the type of cinemas that we're all going to rely on to kind of keep us entertained in the future, and, you know, ones that will need the money and support more than some of perhaps of the bigger chains. So I would recommend getting behind those campaigns. So we'll put a wee link in sort of the Twitter notes for this episode.
Yeah, no, I've donated today as well. So I used to work at the Belmont Film House, and I've worked with for the Film House at the Edinburgh Film Festival and stuff like that. So obviously they're two cinemas very close to my heart. And I feel like whatever I pick is just going to be rather cheap and flippant compared to that rather heartfelt, earnest shout out there. So I'm going to go with something which is completely flippant and stupid, and that is the Eurovision Song Contest, The Story of Fire Saga, which is a film which I was not expecting to like at all, but I actually ended up with a massive big smile on my face. It's the kind of film which is silly but really sort of warm and big-hearted, and is just kind of like the kind of warm, fuzzy film which you kind of need right now. It maybe doesn't skewer comedically the song contest as one might expect in like a best in show kind of way, which I thought it was going to do. It turns out Will Ferrell's actually a huge Eurovision fan, so it's much more about sort of celebrating the contest. But I think it kind of works due to the fantastic performance by Rachel McAdams. Some of the songs are actually very good, and you know, it's the kind of film which, if you're from Edinburgh or Glasgow, will drive you as insane in terms of geography as it does with Trainspotting 2. But, you know, it's a film which you can't take too seriously because the Eurovision Song Contest is taking place in Edinburgh, which means that the UK won the previous year, and we all know that didn't happen. And I think it was speaking to Helen O'Hara from Empire Magazine about the film on Twitter, and she said maybe it's set in an alternate universe where Scotland won the independence vote and are in as their own nation, and perhaps won with the Proclaimers. So yeah, I'd like to think that that's how it happened.
Yeah, I haven't seen this one yet, and friend of the show Gary put up a tweet the other day going, I know people are tweeting that you don't have 90 minutes, 2 hours to watch a comedy film. We're in lockdown, of course you do. So I will at some point this week watch it. I only watched Naked Gun for the first time yesterday. So I will watch that this week, or maybe after this episode finishes, I'll maybe get my dinner out and dive into the movie.
Oh, you will. If you enjoy Naked Gun, I have to recommend Police Squad, which might be on Prime as well. The original Police Squad series.
Well, I have watched Police Squad.
You have watched.
I have watched. I watched Police Squad, but somehow I've watched the second Naked Gun movie, but I never watched the first one. So yeah, I watched that last night. So yeah, I'll maybe get the Eurovision film on in the next day or two and get that up and running.
That must be a fascinating film to watch first time, given what happened to O.J. Simpson since. Incredible.
Well, yeah, that's for sure. But thank you very much to everyone for tuning in, and hopefully we'll see you next week, and hopefully we'll see Tenet sooner rather than later. Take care. Bye.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.